Thank you. I'm going to be relating a tale of greed and woe tonight. But before I do that, I'd like to take a survey. How many people have an Apple phone? Please raise your hand. I'm going to count. Okay? Okay. 22, actually. So, Apple. 22. How many have a Samsung phone?
Aha, Apple wins.
That's a medal.
Samsung. 10. How many have something else other than Apple or Samsung?
It has to be Android, right?
Not necessarily. It's probably made by Huawei. Yes? Because they're the number three. And if anybody has one that's other than those three, please put in an advertisement for whichever phone manufacturer phone you have.
Huawei.
Yes, okay.
HTC,
right, okay, fine. So you can see from the survey and actually from statistics that Apple and Samsung are the dominant cell phone providers in the world. And let me give you a short history of why I consider myself qualified to give this talk. I'm a computer scientist. My first advanced degree was a PhD in computer science. I went on soon after that, though, as you can see, to get a law degree at Duquesne University, which is in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where Carnegie Mellon is located. And I've been on the Carnegie Mellon faculty for at least 40 years. And I've been a visiting professor at the University of Hong Kong since 2001. At CMU, I run our largest professional master's program, which is an analogous program to the ECOM-ICOM program here. We call it e-business technology. And it's a full one-year, 12-month program, 53 weeks, actually. In addition to the courses I teach there, I also teach an annual course on law of computer technology at Carnegie Mellon, which focuses on this issue. In legal cases involving technology, there are technological decisions to be made. The problem is that judges are not technologists and jurors are not technologists. Yet they are forced to make very important technological decisions that often have hundreds of millions of US dollars or sometimes billions of US dollars riding on those on the outcomes. And the real question is, how do they do that, and do they do it well, and is there any better way of doing it? And I'm directly involved in many of those disputes. I'm frequently hired as an expert witness, usually in patent cases, and I've done over 200 of them. So lots of experience there. Here's a little montage that shows you what Samsung smartphones looked like before the iPhone. A lot of them had these clunky keyboards, which are difficult to use and sometimes take up more than 50% of the available screen space. Then in January 2007, Apple announces the iPhone. All of a sudden, as if by magic, Samsung smartphones all of a sudden look very different than they did before. In fact, they really look incredibly similar to the iPhone, wouldn't you say?
Yes.
Yes. Now, the question is there anything wrong with that? Isn't capitalism based on competition? So when I see what my competitor is doing, I mimic my competitor, at least the good things that he's doing, to benefit myself. And then one or the other of us might come up with something even better, and the other will imitate that, etc. And so all the products around the world start getting better and better. Well, that works unless there is something about this product that is protectable. That is, that they can use the legal system to prevent Samsung from, for example, making its phone look and feel. I mean, we're down to colors here. We're down to shape and colors. And we're down to individual icons. Is there something that Apple should own about this iPhone that would enable it to prevent Samsung from doing that? Well, in the beginning, it didn't seem to particularly care. However, this is a chart that shows the total sales of cell phones in units by Apple and Samsung. So this is not dollars. This is the actual numbers of phones sold by year. And you can see that in 2010, Apple was dominant. So this is 3 years after the introduction of the iPhone. So Samsung had copied the iPhone. It was out there. It wasn't selling very well compared to the iPhone. So Apple wasn't particularly concerned, apparently. They didn't take any steps to stop it. Then in 2011, they're about equal. But the trend is bad because the percentage of the market that Samsung is getting is increasing. And so what happens is in 2011, the war begins. And Apple fires its opening salvo by filing a lawsuit against Samsung. Well, as you can see from then on, Samsung has become dominant. And if you add up over all these 6 years the total number of units sold, this is 1.3 billion by Samsung and 850 million by Apple. That's a total of over 2 billion cell phones sold between the companies. Now, you know how much cell phones cost. And so you can imagine the revenue implications to these companies of that particular trend. So what are the weapons in Apple's arsenal? They decided to launch an intellectual property war. And they had prepared themselves well for it. Before even introducing the iPhone, they filed various patent applications around the world. They filed trademark applications around the world. They were getting themselves ready just in case there were some infringer. And so these are the four types of intellectual property protection that Apple has used in its lawsuits around the world. The first, and we'll spend probably most of our time on utility patents. So these are the standard kinds of patents that you're familiar with. They protect the manner in which a product functions. And you understand that in a cell phone, there are a huge number of functions. There's GPS. There's a touch screen. There are things that sense various gestures that you make by moving your fingers across the touch screen. There is an operating system. There is interaction between the various radio receivers and the software on the machine. I mean, you could make a list probably of at least 1,000 different technological points that when all put together will form an iPhone. And so Apple owns many, many, many patents covering the iPhone. And they allege that a number of those patents were infringed by Samsung. Now, it's a little difficult when you have a few hundred million phones out there to suddenly remove features from those phones. So if Samsung had to change its designs because Apple was upset or Apple won a lawsuit, it would have major implications for Samsung. Another kind of patent that you might not be familiar with is something called a design patent. It's called a design in the United States. It's called a registered design in Hong Kong. There's a different term that's used in Europe. But basically, design patents protect a certain aspect of the design of things. Not all the aspects, but the ornamental aspects. That is, the non-functional parts of the design. So, I have a Samsung phone. There are some non-functional aspects to it. One is, to a certain extent, the shape of the corners. Although one can argue that you don't want sharp corners on a cell phone because it would hurt you. And so there's some actual degree of functionality to that curve. Now, there's some stuff on here that's black and there's some stuff that's blue. Those, I think, don't have functional component. So those are ornamental. And so the various placement of the different functional parts on here, where they're put and how they look can be an ornamental design. And so Apple alleged that it had design patents on many, many ornamental features of the iPhone. Then trademarks. The idea of a trademark is to enable the public to associate a producer or a source of a product with the product itself. So this bottle of water says Vita on it. And if you like Vita water, it's very easy for you to find it. If you go to the grocery store, you look down the shelf of all the waters, and all of a sudden, there's the one that you recognize, that you know comes from the producer that you like. And so Vita, in fact, it even says TM right there, trademark. Vita is a trademark of some company. I don't know what the name of the company is.
It's Vita.
It might be Vita. It's Vitasoy. Yes, correct. Vitasoy. But as long as you associate the trademark with a unique source of goods, then it functions as a trademark. And Apple believed that the mere look of its phone, when people saw one from a distance, they recognized it as an iPhone, and so therefore it was associated with Apple. Now Samsung comes along and makes something that almost looks like an iPhone, and if you see this from a distance, if you don't see the word Samsung on there, you might think that this was produced by Apple. And so that's an infringement of Apple's trademark. If it's a valid trademark, that would be an infringement. And then an unusual concept in intellectual property is referred to as trade dress. Trade dress is similar to a trademark, except it isn't a mark. It's an overall look of a product. A good example of trade dress is a McDonald's restaurant that has golden arches. You go try to open a restaurant that has golden arches and see what happens to you. Okay? You might even have difficulty opening some other kind of establishment that isn't a restaurant using the golden arches, because they're so famous that people would tend to believe, oh, you're selling automobile tires? I didn't know that McDonald's was in the automobile tire business. That's news to me. And so you would probably be shut down no matter what use you tried to make of the golden arches. Well, naturally, Apple asserted that the overall look and feel, the way in which you interact with the iPhone, was the trade dress of Apple, and therefore it would be infringed if Samsung phones function similarly. All right. So let's take a look at what Apple was really asserting here. So I have to give you a little background on utility patents first. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to follow me when I go through the actual patents that were asserted by Apple. So a utility patent, which covers the functionality of a product, has two parts. A patent, of course, is actually a piece of paper. It's a publication issued by a government that has the government seal on it. And so it's nothing else. It's a piece of paper. And the piece of paper has two parts. The first part is called the specification. And by the way, the patent is not written by the government. The patent is written by the inventor. And it's the inventor's obligation in the specification to tell how to make and use the invention. This is what I invented. Here's how you make it. Here's how you use it. Now, sometimes the specification contains drawings. It very often does. Those may be the equivalent of mechanical drawings that literally show you what kinds of metal parts you would have to cut out and put together in order to make the invention. If it's software, it may describe data structures. It may describe a software architecture, interaction, APIs, interaction with an operating system to accomplish various things. If it's a razor, it may include instructions on what kind of grinding machine is necessary to make a razor of this exact shape and sharpness. Whatever field the invention is in, there have to be instructions to people who are skilled in that particular art, teaching them how to make the invention. If you don't do that, you can't get a patent. But this long verbal description does not constitute what your invention is. It would be very difficult to tell. I mean, it's like reading a novel and saying, well, what's the message? What's the message of War and Peace? Everybody who reads it would come up with something different. So if I gave you the specification of an invention and I asked everybody in the room, what's the invention? You would all give different descriptions of it. And if you did that, we could never have a definitive patent infringement suit. You'd never know whether somebody infringed the patent or not. So the second part of utility patents are the claims. And the claims are very strange because they're written in words. In U.S. patents, they're written in English. It's an English language description of what the inventor considers his invention to be. An analogy that's often drawn between claims and something in the familiar world is a deed to land. If I sell you land, there's a piece of paper called a deed that describes the exact boundaries so that a surveyor can go out to the land and mark out what the edges of the property are. And that description is actually in words. I mean, it has some numbers in it. Usually it has numbers of, it has distances, and it may have some latitudes and longitudes. But it basically has a description of, from this point, southwest, 150 meters, thence northeast, et cetera, et cetera. It's in words. Well, we all understand how to describe boundaries of land. The problem is describing a complicated invention like a piece of an iPhone may be difficult to do in words. What you might really want to do is draw a picture. But claims cannot have pictures in them. They only have words. So the inventor writes his specification and he writes his claims. It's what he thinks his invention is. It's up to the government then to decide whether he ought to get the patent. And the way that they decide that is they compare it with what's referred to as prior art, that which has come before. Inventions, at least in all civilized countries, patent laws are very similar around the world, particularly for mechanical kinds of inventions. And so the patent law in Hong Kong is essentially the same as the patent law in the United States, at least with respect to what is patentable. Inventions have to be new, which means not invented before, but they also have to be non-obvious. If something is obvious, it may be that it was never invented before, but anybody looking at the prior thing would immediately think of the new thing. And we're not going to award you a monopoly for that. And there are many kinds of traditional principles about what is obvious and what's not obvious. So, for example, making something smaller is obvious. So if I have a laser pointer that is 5 inches long and somebody makes a laser pointer that's 2.5 inches long, it's obvious to do that. Now, it may not be obvious to make a laser pointer that is 1 millimeter long because you can't fit a battery in there. You might not even be able to fit a standard laser in there. So if you can make the transformation from what was old to what you think your invention is without making new invention, then it's obvious. And we're not going to give you a patent for that. Okay? Now, novelty, whether it's new or not, and obviousness are considered from the standpoint of one having ordinary skill in the relevant art. Not geniuses and not lay people from the street. People who have ordinary familiarity with the laser pointer art, for example, are the ones to whom the patent is addressed. Now, you understand that, I'll get to that in a minute. So this person of ordinary skill in the art is assumed to be familiar with all pertinent prior art. He has knowledge of all publications in the field and all prior inventions. Naturally, no such person actually exists. Okay, I've never even met somebody who claimed to be such a person. Okay, now, problem. A juror sitting on a jury is usually not one of ordinary skill. If they are, the attorneys make an effort to not have them be on the jury. The reason is that, let's suppose I have an engineering patent, something related to an iPhone, and we're picking a jury, and we find there's some guy who has a degree in electrical engineering, has a lot of experience with wireless. If I am the owner of the patent, you might think I'd want him because he would totally understand my invention. The problem is, he is going to dictate to the rest of the jury. They're not going to know anything, and they're going to look to his opinion. And so he personally is going to end up deciding the whole case. And I might not want that unless I'm sure he's with me. And if I'm sure he's with me, the other side is going to be sure he's against them, and they're not going to want him on the jury either. So probably both sides are not going to pick somebody who actually has ordinary skill. And so I don't want to refer to the lay jurors as dumb, but they are deliberately hand-picked so they don't have skill in this particular art. A judge usually isn't one of ordinary skill either, although there are some judges in the United States who have degrees in computer science, and that certainly informs some of their decisions in the cases. But as a general matter, the judge is not going to be one of ordinary skill. So if all this stuff is evaluated from the viewpoint of one of ordinary skill, and nobody in the courtroom, except maybe the experts, have ordinary skill, then how are the jurors to decide? Well, I gave it away. The answer is you hire experts. The experts form opinions, and they come into court, and they explain to the jury why their opinion is correct. The problem is each one of them usually makes a very convincing presentation, reaching totally opposite conclusions. And so how does the jury decide? They can't decide on the technical merits. What they usually do is decide who looked better, who was dressed better, who withstood cross-examination better. Did somebody stutter and sweat when he was asked questions by the other side, or did he take it confidently and give it right back to the attorney? Or They may not even listen to the experts. They may decide whether they like one side or the other. Maybe the people who have Apple phones want Apple to win. Who knows how the jurors decide. Okay, so I've told you what a patent is. Now we have to talk about what infringement is. The test for infringement is actually quite simple. Does at least one claim of the patent read on, and that's the actual words that we use, read on, which means apply to the accused product. So let's suppose there's a patent on a laser pointer. And remember that claim is a bunch of words that describe what the invention is. Okay? And so let's say the first thing is a cylindrical metallic tube. Well, what happens is somebody holds the laser pointer and looks to see whether there is a cylindrical metallic tube. And if so, they check that off. And a switching button embedded in said tube. Okay? Yes. And a battery installed within said tube. Yes. A pocket clip on the exterior of said tube. Yes, yes, yes. And if the answer is yes to everything, everything in the claim is found in the what is referred to as the accused product or the accused device. It's sort of like pointing at the laser pointer. J'accuse. Okay. It's like, you know, it's very human. Okay. If the answer is yes, that the claim reads on the product, then there is infringement. Okay? Every part of the claim, however, must be found in the product. If any one little thing is missing, there is no infringement. Infringement is determined from the viewpoint of one of ordinary skill in the art. But of course, the jurors aren't that, and the judge isn't that. But they're the ones that have to make the determination as to whether there's infringement. Now, design patents. Functional parts of a product are protected by utility patents. If there is a particular way in which your product functions and you want to protect that, you go get a utility patent. If you want to protect the ornamental features, this has ornamental features, actually. It has caps that are made of a different color metal than the body. It has a clip that's of a different color metal. There's a particular shape to that clip, and some of it is functional because it has to act as a spring, but some of it is artistic, the way it is contoured, for example. And those aspects of this laser pointer could be protected by a design patent. So ornamental, non-functional aspects can be protected. Design patents have a much shorter term. In Hong Kong, it's 5 years. In the United States, it's 14 years. So the test for infringement. When we go to court, and your jurors are sitting there, and the judge has to explain to them, what do they have to do to find an infringement of a design patent? The answer is, are the designs, that is, I have the design patent, which is going to have a picture in it, and I have the accused thing, and those are the two designs. Are the designs substantially the same as seen by the ordinary observer who is familiar with the prior art? So I have to have seen lots of laser pointers. And given the entire field of laser pointers, do these two seem substantially similar? Okay? Well, a juror is an ordinary observer. A judge is an ordinary observer. The problem is they're not familiar with the prior art. They haven't studied laser pointers. So how do they become familiar with it? The witnesses at trial will tell them all about how many thousands of laser pointers there have been and show them pictures of the thousands of laser pointers so they can decide whether these two are substantially similar. Okay. Now, let's take a look at one of Apple's design patents. And this is an important one because they originally won about $725 million for this one. So it was worth the legal fees, at least temporarily, was worth the legal fees for them to file this design patent. You notice a couple of things. One of them is that Steve Jobs is one of the inventors of this patent. So these are the guys who are inventors. And the owner of the patent is Apple Inc., located in Cupertino, California. It was filed November 18th, 2008. And there is the drawing. That is what they consider to be their design. It says, the ornamental design of an electronic device as shown and described. There it is. That's what they patented. Now, if we want to look at infringement, you have to look at the prior art. You have to look at all the cell phones that there were, put a Samsung one in front of you, and put that drawing in front of you, and decide, amidst this very crowded field of cell phones, are those two things substantially similar? There was at least one jury that did that. Now, 6 days before the release of the iPhone in June 2007, Apple filed another design patent application in which it submitted 193 screenshots in color to the patent office. This one up here, you will see later. That one figured very prominently in the first suit that they brought against against Samsung. So, in case you can't see that picture very well, there it is. Okay? It's U.S. design patent 604,305. And it shows an arrangement of icons. Now, of course, suppose I took this and I made everything exactly the same, but I made that red instead of green. Would the two be substantially similar or not? Probably. Okay? Now, suppose I make that one red and I make that one yellow. Are they substantially similar? In fact, suppose I change the color of all of them, but I don't change anything else about them. Would they be substantially similar or not? And then the question is, should Apple have been granted this patent at all? Because isn't arrangement of icons on screens an incredibly common thing? That's the way that you use icons, is by having them on screens. So maybe they shouldn't have even gotten the patent. All right. Well, forearmed with all of these patents that they have, Apple then launches the war. And when I draw this map, the first thing it reminded me of is World War II. Because look at the theaters of action. Okay, we have Asia over here, Australia, MacArthur's down there. We have Italy and Europe. What's missing is China and North Africa. Okay, but other than that, it looks like World War II. They're fighting all over the world. And in fact, Apple filed 20 lawsuits in 9 countries on 4 continents against Samsung. Why? Because billions of cell phones are at issue here, and hundreds of billions of dollars in revenue are at stake here. So let's take a look at what went on in Apple v. Samsung 1. That was filed in the United States in April of 2011. Now, all the U.S. suits have been brought in the Northern District of California. That's actually Silicon Valley. You might consider San Francisco to be in the middle of California. But the way the judicial districts are arranged in California, from San Francisco on all the way up to the top of the state, so nobody lives up there, half the state is the Northern District of California. And so that is the common place in which technology lawsuits are brought, particularly by companies that happen to have headquarters in Silicon Valley. Why? Because what is the chance that some juror is going to have no friends and no relatives who work for Apple? If they live a few miles, if the courthouse is a few miles from Apple's corporate headquarters, that's why Apple brings its suits in California, in Silicon Valley. So they allege that 21 Samsung products infringe 3 different Apple patents. Now, from the point of view of a litigator, their presentation was brilliant because they took these 3 patents and they picked 1 claim from each patent. They kept the case as simple as possible, because they wanted the jurors with them. They wanted the jurors to understand everything. I've been in cases where 150 claims have been asserted, and the jurors can't keep anything straight. So this was brilliant of Apple. Now, this patent covers the feature of rubber banding, when things snap to boundaries. The 915 patent, which we will actually look at, is the difference between scrolling and pinching. So if I take one finger, and I go like this, I scroll up and down on the screen. But if I take 2 and I move them apart, it expands and contracts the image. They have a patent on that. Very valuable patent, because every cell phone I know uses that uses that gesture. And then tap to zoom, well, they have another patent on that. So we're going to look at claim 8 of the 915 patent. If you touch 1 point, you scroll. If you touch 2 points, you resize. That's it. Okay? 1 claim. This is the claim that was asserted by Apple. Now, before getting into it, I have to tell you some things about patent litigation. It's very expensive. The average cost to defend 1 claim of 1 patent is about US $3 million. Average. It sometimes costs much more. The jury determines whether there was infringement or not. It's regarded as a matter of fact, whether there was or there wasn't. Jurors determine matters of fact. The jury also determines whether the patent is valid or not. Now, this may be a surprise, because the government issued it. And so, how do these small number of people sitting in a room in California decide that the government was wrong and never should have issued the patent? Well, they have the power to do that. The reason that this is so is that when you file a patent, it's not exactly an adversarial process. It's between you and the government. But other people who might be interested in whether you get the patent or not do not participate in the process. So there may be prior art out there that the patent office never saw. If they had seen it, maybe they wouldn't have issued the patent. This doesn't come to light until you actually sue somebody. When you sue somebody, they're very interested in having your patent not be valid. They scour the earth for prior art. They go to libraries in Estonia and find documents that nobody can read that show prior art. Really, they do. And if it's in Estonian, but it was publicly accessible, it's prior art. Because remember, the one of ordinary skill is presumed to be familiar with the entire prior art. And if you can convince the jury that the patent office shouldn't have issued the patent, they have the power to declare the patent null and void. That's a very important defense, because very often you are infringing, but the patent shouldn't have been granted. And you're never going to convince them that you're not infringing, because you are. It's just that the patent should not have been granted. The jury determines money compensation. So if the patent is infringed and it's valid, then you're owed some money. And the jury determines what amount of money you're going to get. The judge then determines whether the jury's decisions have sufficient basis in evidence. Sometimes jurors go crazy. They like one party so much that they give judgment for that party, when in fact, if you look at the actual evidence that came up in the trial, there's no basis for that decision. So the judge can nullify what the jury does. But the judge's nullification is reviewed by higher courts. Judge can't just do it on a whim. Okay? In the United States, all U.S. patent cases are reviewed by one single appeals court. It's called the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. It sits in Washington, D.C. The reason for that is we want our patent law to be uniform across the whole country. And even though we have many different appeals courts, we just want one of them to be handling patent cases. All right, so let's look at that, the scroll versus gesture patent. It still has a lot of words, but the concept is very simple. So this is Claim 8, the one that was asserted by Apple. A machine-readable storage medium. How about this? Let's do a read-on. I have a Samsung phone. Let's do a read-on. A machine-readable storage medium storing executable program instructions, which when executed cause a data processing system to perform a method comprising, and then there's some steps. Does this have a machine-readable storage medium? Obviously. Does it store executable program instructions? Yes. When executed, do they cause a data processing system to perform certain steps? Yes. So we can check this off. Okay. Receiving a user input. The user input is one or more input points applied to a touch-sensitive screen. So one or more means at least one, but any number. You could 3, 4, 5, any of that. That would satisfy A. Okay? So receiving user input, the user input is one or more input points applied to a touch-sensitive display that is integrated with the data processing system. It's integrated. It's all manufactured together. So we can check off A. Creating an event object in response to the user input. Okay, there we're going to have to go into the guts of the software to determine whether object-oriented programming is used and whether an event object is created. And so the jurors have no idea what an event object is. So the experts get up there and they explain what an event object is and they explain why the Samsung phone has one. So you can take it from me, this was checked off. Okay. Determining whether the event object invokes a scroll or gesture operation by distinguishing between a single input point applied to the touch-sensitive display that is interpreted as the scroll operation and two or more input points applied to the touch-sensitive display that are interpreted as the gesture operation. Well, you know you can do that on a Samsung phone, so we check off C. Issuing at least one scroll or gesture call based on invoking the scroll or gesture operation. So there's going to be some procedure. There's going to be a separate scroll procedure and a separate resize procedure that will be invoked. based on the detection of what the gesture is. So D. Responding to at least one scroll call, if issued, by scrolling a window having a view associated with the event object. Or responding to at least one gesture call, if issued, by scaling the view associated with the event object based on receiving the two or more input points in the form of the user input. And that's the end of the claim, and we checked off A through F, and it's infringed. Okay? Real simple. I'll bet it took a little longer than that to present that to the jury than the 3 minutes that we just went through. But nonetheless, I think it would be pretty clear, even to somebody off the street, once you explained to him what an event object was and what the difference between gesturing and scrolling was, they would easily see that there was infringement. Of course, you know, I'm sure that was vigorously contested by Samsung. But Samsung ultimately lost that one, because it's clear that if this patent is valid, it's infringed by Samsung. So here's Apple's other defense, and that is the patent's invalid and never should have been issued. And they came up with this Japanese patent that was issued in the year published in the year 2000. Okay, so it's long before the Apple iPhone. And Japanese patents have an interesting structure. They all start out with a statement of the problem to be solved. Japanese, very practical. Okay, the reason you have a patent is there's a problem to be solved, and here's the solution: to provide an electronic book and a portable information equipment capable of realizing functions such as rotating, magnifying, reducing, and scrolling of a map picture with a human interface, dot, dot, dot. I don't want to read this whole thing, but I've put this stuff in red for a reason. Moreover, the reducing instruction and the reducing amount of the map picture can be inputted by an operation bringing the two fingers closer. Doesn't that sound a lot like pinch to resize? That is pinch to resize. The only thing it doesn't say is that you can expand it by bringing your fingers apart. But you can. But notice there wasn't any enlargin. If you look back at Claim 8 in Apple's claim, it didn't say it had to reduce and enlarge. It just said it had to resize. And this clearly is showing resizing. Okay? Not to put all their eggs in one basket, they found another piece of prior art. So this is a paper by Jefferson Hahn that appeared in the SIGGRAPH proceedings in the year 2005, before the iPhone appeared. Low-cost multi-touch sensing through frustrated total internal reflection. Jefferson Hahn at NYU. You can see here there are multiple fingers going across the touch screen at the same time. So putting the various pieces of prior, there were others, but putting these various pieces of prior art together, Samsung argued that the Patent Office never should have issued that 915 patent, that Claim 8, which just talks about exactly the stuff that's talked about in the Japanese patent and in the Hahn article. Now, the jury completely ignored that. Okay? So on August 24, 2012, after a three-week trial, a jury found that Samsung had willfully infringed. Not only did they infringe, but they knew of the Apple patents and they knew they were infringing them. Three utility patents and four design patents. The jury then went on to find all of the patents valid, all seven of them. The jury found that Samsung had infringed and diluted the trade dress of the iPhone. Looked the same, right? Substantially similar from a distance. The case docket, if you go to it, you can, it's publicly available. That's a list of all the documents that the attorneys filed with the court. That's a lot less than the total number of documents in the case. These are just the ones that were filed. I checked yesterday and there were 3,430 entries. Now, a typical cost to prepare and file a document in court is about $10,000. So if you do the multiplication, that's at least $34 million to file those documents. And that's not the only cost of the case. I mean, there was a trial after all. And so the legal fees so far are probably greater than $50 million in that case. So what does the jury do? Here's the verdict form. So when the jury goes into the jury room, they're given a form that is hotly contested by the parties and finally approved by the judge as to the exact wording of everything on the form. The form was very long. It was 20 pages long. They had many decisions that they had to make. There are seven patents. There are 21 different models of Samsung phones. They got to decide for every one of them. But I'm just summarizing it for you. The last question on the form was, what is the total dollar amount that Apple is entitled to receive from Samsung on the claims on which you've ruled in favor of Apple? And it's a very big number. It's so big that they didn't get it right the first time they wrote it. And so they had to cross it out and put a different number, and the jury foreperson, I guess, had to initial it to show that it hadn't been forged or something. But if you look at it, actually, it's over $1 billion. Okay, $1 billion awarded to Apple. Okay, so they award damages of $1.049 billion. Now here's the law of willful infringement for you in one sentence. If infringement be willful, increased damages may be awarded at the discretion of the district court, that's the judge, and the amount of increase may be set in the exercise of that same discretion. The court may increase the damages up to 3 times the amount found or assessed. So if it's gross willful infringement, the judge can triple the amount to $3 billion if he wants to. Okay? However, Samsung successfully appealed. They said there were so many errors that occurred in this case, it is not fair to us to have this verdict stand. We want a new trial, at least on the issue of damages. So they got a new trial. And still sort of part of Apple v. Samsung 1. So on the retrial of damages, the jury still found in favor of Apple, but this time for $290 million. That was upheld by the Federal Circuit on May 18, 2015, a little less than a year ago. However, the Federal Circuit vacated the trade dress infringement finding. They said, nah, there wasn't sufficient evidence on the trade dress. And so we're going to have to send it back for a third trial because the jury was not asked to distinguish that even though for each product they had to list an amount that Apple was due, they didn't split it out by patent and by trade dress count. And so it was all mixed together. And so if you subtract trade dress, we don't know. Maybe the jury awarded the whole thing just for trade dress. We don't know. And so because we don't know, there's another trial coming, and it's actually about to start in the next few weeks. It will start in California.
So Apple didn't get this $1 billion?
No. This is still, it's not a final judgment yet.
I see.
Okay, but wait. It gets worse. Okay. So Apple and Samsung were also battling in the other countries that I showed you on the map. The judge in California called the case one action in a worldwide constellation of litigation between the two companies. I think the point came when even these companies were sick of paying lawyers. This is something that happens to people usually very soon. Okay, so what Apple and Samsung did was agreed that we're going to settle all the cases outside the United States, but we're going to allow the U.S. cases to continue. Okay, that at least cut the legal bleeding to some extent. So there's Apple v. Samsung 2. Apple v. Samsung 2 was filed about a year after the first one, same court, Northern District of California. This time, there were 9 Samsung products, but there were 46 different models, and 5 different patents were asserted. One of them was swipe to unlock. So what's the first thing that happens when you turn on your Samsung phone? You have to swipe in order to unlock it. Apple has a patent on that. Okay? I want to make a long story short, and that is Samsung defended again the same way. They scoured the world for prior art, and they found the Neonode reference, key lock, unlocking the unit. The on-off switch is located on the left side of the N1 below the screen. Press the power button once. The text, right sweep to unlock, appears on the screen. Sweep right to unlock your unit. Doesn't that sound like sweep to unlock? Yeah, it does to me. Then there's another piece of prior art, the Plaisant reference. Okay, this is a screen, and the screen has on, off. On, off. Doesn't that look like swipe to unlock? Jury didn't buy it. Jury found the patent valid. Okay, so what does the jury do? It awards $119 million in damages to Apple against Samsung, approved by the judge. Okay, that docket, as of yesterday, had 2,159 entries, so you can figure out how much that case cost. However, a few days ago, The Federal Circuit found all claims of the Apple's patents asserted against Apple, against Samsung, to be invalid, just like you saw. The prior art that I showed you probably gave you the impression those patents never should have been issued. Well, the Federal Circuit found exactly that and reduced the $120 million award to zero. Furthermore, Apple was found to have infringed a Samsung patent, and Samsung was awarded $158,400, a symbolic victory because the cost of them to obtain that was probably $10 million. All right, now, let me tell you about the judge, the Honorable Lucy Koh. She was the judge in both of the cases. Here are some biographical particulars. She's the only female U.S. federal judge of Korean descent. Samsung is a Korean company, but she regularly found against Samsung, so nobody's accusing her of racial bias. Okay? She presided over all the U.S. Apple v. Samsung trials. Her Apple v. Samsung decisions were all reversed by the Federal Circuit. All so far, every one of them has been reversed. On February 25th, the day before the reversal, she was nominated for promotion by President Obama. She was nominated for a seat on the Court of Appeals, actually not the Federal Circuit, but because she's not a patent attorney. But she was nominated to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is in California. So the day after he nominates her, her decisions in Apple v. Samsung 2 were reversed by the Federal Circuit. Nonetheless, she will probably be approved by the U.S. Senate. Now, why? Because she conducted herself extraordinarily well and with great judicial temperament, despite making numerous wrong decisions. Nonetheless, she acted very extremely judicial.
And I thought it's the jury who...
But what happens is, yes, the jury makes the decision. Then let's suppose they award damages in favor of Apple. Then what Samsung does is they come along and they say to the judge, there was not sufficient evidentiary basis for the jury's decision. Will you please vacate the jury's decision? That's a determination the judge makes. And every one of those that she made was wrong. Right? They wanted her to find the patents invalid because of the prior art. She wouldn't. And the Federal Circuit said, you should have. They're invalid. Are you kidding me? Look at that prior art that we just looked at. And the trial lasted a lot more than an hour, and we've been only going 50 minutes here, and I was able to largely convince you in 50 minutes that at least two of Apple's patents were invalid. Why did it take years? I mean, this was the case. Initial case was filed in 2011. The reversal comes 5 years later in 2016. So, summary, major ideas of tonight. Patents have a major effect on the technology sector. If you're facing $1 billion in damages, you're willing to spend a huge amount to defend yourself. Decisions on technology questions made by judges and juries can determine, and do determine, the outcome of a lawsuit. Many technology patents that are out there never should have been granted. An adverse patent infringement verdict can involve huge, huge amounts of money. There aren't that many lawsuits that result in a $1 billion judgment. Yeah, 100 million, yeah. A billion, no, it's rare. Judges can overrule the jury when there's no substantial evidence to support the jury's verdict. They can, but they often don't. Reason is they don't want to get reversed. Of course, they do get reversed if they make the wrong decision. An appeals court can overrule a lower court when an error of law is made or there was no substantial evidence to support the jury's verdict. And that's exactly what the Federal Circuit has done. And it is extremely likely... You heard it here first. Even though Samsung won, Apple v. Samsung won is still going on. Remember, there's a third trial coming up on damages. My belief is that when it gets to the Federal Circuit, the damages will be reduced to zero, because that's the one that includes the one finger versus two finger gesture. And you know, sitting here, that claim is not valid. You know that.